This is the Biblical Mind Podcast, produced by the Center for Hebraic Thought. Honest five-star reviews help others find this podcast. Visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org for articles and videos that explore the deep structures of Scripture.
The Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, introduces a God who is anti-slavery, an anti-slavery God. And we see this from the very beginning. We see it particularly in the foundational event of the Exodus. So this foundational event shows us a God who is hearing the cry of the people. He's seeing their plight, and he wants to respond to that. This reveals to us the character of God, but not only his character, it reveals to us his plans for Israel and for humanity at large. So for me, the fact that God introduces himself from the very beginning as the God who brings people out of slavery is really huge. And it is something that I can hold on, I can bring to kind of a more diachronic application. So I can see that the same God, if it's the same God today, he feels particularly strongly about similar issues, parallel issues for today's society. And the issue of trafficking today is huge. It's the third most profitable trade in the world after guns and drugs. Mm. And even though we have abolished legally slavery, it's still very much being practiced all over the world, under the radar or sometimes even in front of our eyes. So I feel that the church that claims to be in the image of this God should demonstrate in the world, in society today, the same concerns, similar concerns for this issue, especially regarding the freedom of people, the slavery of people. Mm-hmm. This particular issue, the issue of slavery, is also something that affects the entire Old Testament. It's not just an Exodus issue. It affects the legal code of Israel to maintain and to preserve the freedom of the people, to make sure that we avoid situations that would potentially enslave anyone again. It's a really strong value. It's a really strong driving force for the legislation of Israel, but also we see it in the prophets. It's a major concern as well. So I do see kind of a theme, an anti-slavery theme throughout the Old Testament. And of course, you can take that not only physically, but also we can see the spiritual dimensions of that, especially when we come to the New Testament. It does not undo the physical dimensions. It doesn't go to the back burner. It's already stated. It's already a given. No need to be repeated, in a sense. But now we have a broader dimension that has come to the foreground. Not in the New Testament. It doesn't start with the New Testament. It's already there in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. The spiritual dimension of people, the spiritual slavery of the people.
You're an Old Testament scholar by trade, but I think most people would, in their minds, think of the Old Testament as the book of slavery. That's where God approves of slavery, and then the New Testament as where Jesus came to set the prisoners free, right? I think that would be the caricature that a lot of people would carry around. Mm. So I wonder if you could really quickly disentangle, because you said, well, the anti-slavery theme, but then you have God permitting some forms of servitude and slavery. So how do you see those as working together as an anti-slavery theme, but permitting slavery?
Mm. Yes. So God inherits a fallen world, let's say. So when he comes to meet the people, they're already in this fallen world, or slavery is widespread all over the ancient world. It's kind of a given. It's the air they breathe, let's say. Mm. So what I see is God beginning to take the Israelites a step further, a step towards humanization of slaves, of slavery. So we do have various texts that dictate how one should treat their slave. I have recently looked at the various laws on slavery, and I saw that the law of the fugitive, for example. So if someone is oppressed by their master, they're not they're suffering under their master, and they decide to flee, then one should offer shelter, should offer an asylum to that slave, which means that potentially any form of bad slavery or of oppressive slavery, of a slavery that doesn't function like a boss and their employee. This is the kind of relationship that should happen. If it doesn't function this way, then the text gives freedom, let's say, to the slave to flee and be given asylum from such a master. So we do see various laws that humanize the slaves, and they take us a step further towards, well, not complete freedom. This is something that we could argue that the New Testament opens the door for that, but there may be texts in the Old Testament as well that open the door for that. Nobody is instructed to have slaves. Actually, it's for the slave trade is forbidden in Israel. So that's a significant parting from slave trades in the ancient world. So we could see, let's say, sort of a trajectory towards an understanding of equality between the master and the slave, and freedom for the slave to choose whether to stay with you or be free. So given this this ugly world of slavery, we do have some liberating texts if one chooses to read them this way.
Yeah, I think that word you use, that it humanizes the servitude relationship. And I wonder also, I've been on this kick lately, so I'll put the same question to you that I put to Esau McCulley on his book, that in Exodus, it's the cruel and oppressive nature, as you said, of slavery that's being highlighted there, especially in Exodus 1. But then the metaphor of slave is used for Israel and for Moses and for even in the New Testament that we're slaves of Christ. So the metaphor actually doesn't go away. It remains. But do you see that as kind of redeeming the relationship in some way, or redeeming the metaphor? Or should we still talk about ourselves as slaves to God? Or when does it become inappropriate? And now, I'll give you his answer really quickly.
Oh, really? Yeah.
He basically said, yeah, the metaphor is okay, obviously, because the biblical authors are using it. But there would be some communities in which that would be just too traumatizing to speak in that way. And so it would be inappropriate. And I wonder, you had this, it's a ministry to help people out of human trafficking, sex trafficking. Would that be the same for you? Is that it's maybe it's a true and good metaphor, but it's just not useful for people who are currently enslaved.
Yes, I agree with Esau. Yes, that we have to think of the context in which this word is spoken and what are the connotations that the word carries in each context. In the ancient context, everybody was a slave. Even the king was a slave to the god. So it functions as an honorary title. People would not think outside of slavery in a sense. But of course, I think the whole of the Bible takes concepts and words and fills them with new meaning, or corrects the bad meaning that they have acquired through time or in various contexts that were bad. So it's okay to maintain the same word, but fill it with new meaning. So it's like saying about Jesus, speaking about Jesus' authority. He speaks of his authority, but he defines it differently. He speaks of his kingdom, and he defines it differently. So he actually takes a long time to say, how is the kingdom of heaven? And so he wants to fill the same word with a totally different content than they were used to. So he does that. It doesn't mean that we have to abandon the words, but we just have to do a lot more work to fill them with new content. Hmm. So I would, I would discuss this word with the victims of human trafficking who are coming out of this. And I will try to present this concept with the new content that Christ is giving it. But this is up to each person, and it takes wisdom how to act in each specific context. If it's impossible to redeem this word, then perhaps we could find another one. Yes.
Yeah. I think even of, children who've been abused heavily by their fathers, even viewing God as a father can be painful.
So yes.
It takes, like you said, wisdom to think about which metaphors hit at the right times.
Yes.
You're teaching in Athens, Greece, and you also work in this human trafficking. You don't work in human trafficking to help people who have been trafficked and to help people out of trafficking. And I assume some of that traffic is the corridor through Turkey and into Western Europe. What do you think most people don't understand about human trafficking, or maybe they just are ignorant of?
There's many things.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, first of all, we have to think about the conditions that produce a victim of trafficking. And there's many, many factors that contribute to these conditions. One of them is the place of women in society. If a woman is not given the same position in society, doesn't have the same opportunities, if they live an abandoned life by their husband or the males of the household, and they have to be the main carers of their family, this adds a lot of constraint on them to do anything in their power to raise their children. So, for example, I've met a lot of victims they fell into the net of traffickers out of their need for money, because their children were sick, they had to pay for their surgeries, things like that. So this is a big factor. Poverty is a huge factor. What has contributed to their poverty? Another factor is in the receiving country where these victims are kept and they're working, in quotation marks. How are they listened to? How are they approached? If there is a perception in society that, these are prostitutes, don't listen to them. If you have a particular way of thinking of a woman prostitute, you don't see her as a victim. You see her as, she wanted this. It was her choice. Let her pay for it now. If you think this way, then you're perpetuating this situation, and there's no way you would get out of your way to help them, to inquire into their case, to inquire into their situation. So many times we have even from the police reluctance to help these women who go to report something or who need help. The other issue is our view towards the foreigner, because most of the trafficked victims are foreigners. The majority of them come from Eastern Europe and Africa. If a rhetoric of anti-immigration has developed a lot in the country and has created this sentiment that the foreigner has come here and he's the enemy, she's the enemy, they're coming to take our jobs, that we want them to leave, we don't want to help them, we don't want to give them refuge, then you're not very likely to receive with open arms any of these victims that come to you, seek help, seek a refuge. So you can see how many factors can be contributing to beginning and maintaining this this problem.
And forgive me, because I grind everything through the sausage grinder of the Bible. Like, I think about the Torah, how how specific it is about widows, orphan women, foreigners, people who are vulnerable, to be treated as the native born, to be welcomed in, to be joined in. I think about how much of the Torah is dedicated to looking out for these very types of people as a stable nation who's supposed to be able to accept these kinds of people, so that people could even be, you know, as it were, trafficked into ancient Israel, and it, the trafficking should have ended there if Israel were doing what she was supposed to do.
Yes, yes, exactly. And this very fact that the social network, the family relations that one has in the country that protect them, even the language factor, the fact that you have property, it's still a huge, item of power in our society. So when these people come, they have no relatives, no one to help them even read the documents they're supposed to sign,
right,
you know.
Right.
So they don't have anyone to run to. So in a way, it's analogous to what has caused Yahweh to say, protect these people, basically because they had no security in the land. They had no property. So we do find an analogous situation today for these people.
Okay, I'm going to hit you with some hard theology at this point, a hard question. Because we talked to Leon Cass, and I've been reading his book on Exodus, and he talks, it's not a brand new idea, but the idea that God brought Israel, the Hebrews, into slavery to kind of bring them all the way down, and that becomes the basis of who they are. So the laws, like in Leviticus 19, love the foreigner as yourself, for you were once foreigners in the land of Egypt, and I am Yahweh your God. And so it's this idea that you love them and treat them in this way because you know what it's like to be this person. So here's the hard question. How do Christians who haven't experienced that, you know, I've been a foreigner I've lived in other countries, and I know exactly what it feels like to be a privileged foreigner, somebody who has some social power and money so I could live adequately. But how do people who've never had that experience learn to treat people that way? I mean, Israel at least had the basis of my parents were stranded. They were slaves, and now we're not. So,
yes, very good question. And I have been thinking about this too a little bit. And I'm very intrigued that this problem is beginning to be addressed already in Deuteronomy, because we are dealing in Deuteronomy with a new generation that has not experienced slavery, that has not experienced Sinai, even most of them. And we have Moses speaking to them. The sermons that are being, the way they're being presented, the rhetoric in Deuteronomy does not distinguish between them and their ancestors. So in a way, any generation that reads Deuteronomy is forced into this experience. It's forced into this history and this background for themselves. So it's not, we are very used to choosing our narrative or making our experience today to be our narrative. But really, the Bible as a whole gives us our narrative. We're not really free to choose who our ancestors are, in a sense. We are children of Abraham. We are children of Abraham. And we are Israel as well. We are grafted in. So the Bible is offering us our history, is offering us our narrative. And I don't think that anyone reading the scriptures that invite you to get into its world and be identified to its world can say, but it didn't happen to me. I've never experienced slavery. So in that sense, I think as I read Deuteronomy, it's really trying to give you to force a narrative on you. This is your narrative. You either choose it, or you either accept it or not. You're not Israel. You're not part of us. So I would respond in this way, because even if you take it in the spiritual way, we're all sinners. We're all children of Adam. We're all fallen. Even there, you still have to say, yes, my ancestor is Adam. I need the second Adam, you know, or you have to say that I am my brother is Jesus Christ now. Mm. He is my older brother, you know. So it's forcing a narrative on you that you have to accept and then act according to that narrative. And I think this is confirmed even by scientific studies, psychological studies, that you are determined, your behavior is determined by the narrative you choose to tell yourself.
Oh, yes.
And it's irrelevant whether that narrative is true or not. Many times we can create false narratives and then act by them. So what the Bible does is it's giving you the true narrative to read yourself into, because you're going to choose one anyway. So why not choose this one and be part of what God has been doing in all of history? So that's how I see it. I think we cannot escape this.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And even as you were saying that, I was thinking two things. Paul, in his epistles, both relates you to Abraham and also calls you the Israel of God. And then in Deuteronomy, which I know is a favorite book of ours, we're saying narrative, but narrative includes all the ritual behaviors, all the pilgrimage, all the, when their sons ask you in the days to come, why these things, what do these stones mean to you in Joshua? You're redefining that narrative for them, even though none of that happened to them. You're giving them the narrative. Yeah, that's so helpful. And so much, I have a lot of 18 to 23 year olds in my college, and so much of my office hours / counseling is they have bought some narrative that I'm just like, why do you believe this narrative? Right? It's not, that's not the narrative we have. Yeah. So important.
Yes.
So you've spent most of your life in Greece, is that correct?
So I was born in Cyprus, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yes, so I was born and raised in Cyprus. And when I was about 20 years old, I moved to Greece because there was no theological school in Cyprus. So I had to move to Greece to study theology. And I came to Athens around 2001. And from there on, I continued my theological studies and went abroad after my studies in Greece, and then returned to Greece to teach at the Greek Bible College in Athens.
Okay. So that was probably a big decision to come back to Greece, I guess, as well. A commitment to Greece.
Yes.
Where evangelicals are a tiny minority, right?
True.
Would they be less than 1% there?
Yes, for sure. Yes, okay. They're less than 1%.
And I wonder when because you have lots of American and British friends, you have lots of friends from all over the world. I see, I follow you on Facebook. I'm particularly interested in what do you think of the American church as you see it? You can be honest here. We're all friends.
Yes, yes. Well, as you said, my friends are amazing. They struggle. My American friends, most of them struggle with the situation, the political situation, these huge divisions, these polarities that have happened in the U.S. As a Greek evangelical, it has an impact on the Greek evangelical church as well, because whenever someone in my country hears the word evangelical, they say, oh, you're a Trump follower. So this is what they see in the news. The evangelicals are supporting Trump. So any evangelicals in our countries must be the same. So this is part of the damage that's being done to the global church, because this is all over the news. But I feel that my friends, most of my friends, really struggle, and they raise the criticisms, the same criticisms that I would raise against the evangelical church that we see at this time. So, yes, I am bothered by the lack of humility. So when I come across churches that have been persecuted for so many years, for centuries, and to see the humility and the spirit of forgiveness in them for their persecutors, and the love that they still show under the knife of their enemy. This is the church I want to learn from. So I am intentionally going to believers from this context to learn what Christianity is. And I'm kind of weary of learning about Christianity from, people who are very sheltered or who think persecution is and the ability, it's the refusal of our ability to say Merry Christmas, you know, things like that. So, yes, I think we have to shift and we have to be disciples of other forms of Christianity that are living differently. They're living more humbly and they have more to tell us about the true spirit of Christianity. So, yeah, it's an invitation to shift our focus.
Amen. Well, you help me with your last name. I know I will say it wrongly.
Theocharous.
The house. Is that gift of God or some version?
Yeah, it's God's grace. Yes, correct.
Yeah, God's grace.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Myrto Theocharous, I know I didn't say it correctly.
Don't Thank worry, so nobody much. Does.
Thank you so much for your wisdom.
Oh, you're welcome.
You've been listening to the Biblical Mind podcast, exploring the deep structures of Christian scripture. For more, visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org. Subscribe to this podcast at all the usual places so you never miss an episode.